Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. On a snowy day in Boston and in the aftermath of the blizzard that wasn't in D.C., it's Heather Hurlburt from the National Security Network.
And it's Daniel Dresner from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Foreign Policy Magazine.
Dresbert rides again.
Yes, we're back by popular demand, apparently, so that's it's nice to know that dozens of people want to hear us.
Hey, that's dozens more people than want to hear me in my suite, so.
That's a fair point.
Anyway, we are digging out in Washington from a snowstorm that turned into a rainstorm. And since Congress bravely declined to go home during this non-snowstorm, we were treated to the Rand Paul old-timey filibuster. 13 straight hours of...
I like old-timey filibuster. Someone needs to copyright that as, like, to make that move. But, yeah, so it was on Wednesday, right? It was on Wednesday. Rand Paul, got up to filibuster the vote on John Brennan to become CIA director. He went for a pretty decent while, if memory serves. He went for 13 hours, I believe, although he did get assistance from a number of his Republican colleagues and at least one Democratic colleague, I believe, assisting him at least in the sense of asking questions, which allowed him to drink some water, even though my understanding is, according to Senate rules, he couldn't leave the chamber and he had to be standing the whole time. Is that correct?
I believe that's right, yes. And actually, one of these had not happened since 2010, and I'm told that
right.
Bernie Sanders, independent senator from Vermont, was the last one. I'm not sure what the topic of that one was.
I'm not sure either, to tell you the truth. I honestly don't know. And it's funny, it didn't generate, let's put it this way, whatever it was, it didn't generate nearly as much press coverage. So, go ahead.
No, so what was fascinating about the press coverage of the Paul filibuster was that Paul has a unique, let's say, take on the issue. And, there was some consternation in some circles that what he chose to focus on was the hypothetical possibility that your government could decide to target and kill Jane Fonda. Or that you could be targeted while you were sitting in a cafe in San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was a certain amount of...
Can I just stop you right there? Because I really think it's important that, in fact, lots of people who would ordinarily go to cafes in Boston or D.C. believe that, in fact, they could be the target of drones, just so I can get the better seats.
It does raise the question of what this would do to Starbucks' stock. I hadn't thought about it from that angle before.
Yeah, it's just sheer jealousy. I mean, as an academic, I do some of my work in cafes, and it's always very annoying when I go to a cafe and all the good seats are taken. So, every once in a while, I wish I could call in a drone strike. Just saying.
Okay. Rand Paul has this particular fascination, and it just unleashed a torrent of activity on the right. Breitbart.com was completely taken over by it. But, in fact, in the course of the 13 hours between him and his colleagues who got up, touched on really a whole range of questions around this set of issues that are raised by having technology that enables us to surveil, target, and kill people with much less on-the-ground sort of tangible involvement, with many fewer of the signs that denoted war in time past. So
yeah.
From the question of where is the United States at war, what does being at war mean, which of the existing legal regimes does that trigger, what kind of congressional oversight triggers it, who is the United States allowed to target and kill this way, who in the United States is allowed to do the targeting, how does this intersect with rules about what kind of force you can use domestically, which is Paul's fascination. So there's a huge, huge set of questions here that are of concern to constitutional lawyers, of concern to civil libertarians, of concern to people who are looking at, what's actually effective in counterterrorism policy, what's counter-effective. NSN put out a paper looking at it from that angle, saying, actually, by the way, if the publics in the countries where you're working don't believe that these strikes are in their best interests, you won't be able to continue them over time. So Rand Paul, kind of lit off this lake of fuel that had been slowly gathering for more than a year around this issue, and it was just fascinating to watch.
Well, I mean, I have a couple of interesting, you know, sort of recollections on this, which is, first, on the one hand, what I kept flashing back to as Paul was filibustering was the whole debate over warrantless wiretapping with the Bush administration, and the question of when, you know, the use of the FISA courts and so on and so forth, and whether or not that was sufficient due process. And you know, in some ways, it gets back to this question. I think Paul's asking I think the larger question that Paul was asking was a valid one, which is what limits are placed on the executive branch in terms of prosecuting a quote unquote war on terror, because it's hard to tell what the legal status of it is. And so in that sense, I thought, you know, it was entirely it was an appropriate use of the old timey filibuster. You know, although I have to say I was bemused by, and in some ways, you know, Eric Holder's response, which he then gave the next day, which was a very curt two-sentence note saying something to the effect of, so I understand that you're curious about whether or not we would use drones against an American citizen on American soil unless we were in a time of war. And the answer is no, which makes it sound very, very clear-cut. But in fact, it hinges crucially on that definition of when exactly are we at war. And so it's, you know, it winds up inviting a lot of lawyerly stuff. The other thing I think that is fascinating about this is the politics of all of it, which is to say, who wound up sort of glomming to Rand Paul's side on this? Which is, on the one hand, you had, for lack of a better way of putting it, the Jim DeMint Republicans is the way I would describe them, because all these people were got where they were because DeMint wound up backing them. So it wasn't just Rand Paul, it was also Ted Cruz, from Texas, Mike Lee from Utah, and Marco Rubio from Florida. Then Mitch McConnell, I believe, also gave a tacit endorsement, as did Saxby Chambliss from Georgia. On the Democrat side, correct me if I'm wrong, Ron Wyden was the only Democrat to speak as well. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and I think it's really misleading to look at it that way, because the way that we got to the point that Ron Paul had the letter and had the filibuster was that Wyden and Udall, Mark Udall, led an effort that then Rand Paul.
Yeah, let's be clear. This is all Rand. You don't want to blame this on Ron. You know.
Yeah, and I do tend to misspeak, so probably any time in this blogging heads that I'm talking about a Paul, I probably mean Rand.
Right. Okay.
I'll try to preemptively ensure myself. But Udall and Wyden really spoke up very courageously right after the leak of, and now we have to go back into ancient history, 2 weeks ago, to the leak of a white paper from the Justice Department, which is not itself the policy on when it's okay to target a U.S. citizen abroad with a military drone or a CIA drone, but it was a summarization of that policy. And you know, in fact, nobody but a few senators on the Intel committees had seen this. The senators on the Judiciary committees had not seen it. Staff were not allowed to see it, much less, you know, members of the population be allowed to see it. So Wyden and Udall went to the White House and said, look, if you are hoping to have John Brennan voted out of our committee with a strong Democratic vote, you will need to release more information, and we understand, in large part thanks to the work of Marcy Wheeler at Fire Dog Lake, that there are a number of these additional memos, and we want to see them. Mm-hmm. And the administration made some moves on that. Paul then also sent a letter saying, I want you to tell me whether you're allowed to kill Americans on American soil, and the answer came back, well, yes, in fact, we are, if you think about the Civil War, Shays Rebellion, et cetera. And that's what set Paul off. So, in fact, you know, Democrats had the baton on the first stage of this. Rand Paul had the baton on the second stage of it.
Right, but I mean, in some ways, this is you can argue that, you know, as much as people talk about party polarization or what have you, this is in fact exactly how the party system is supposed to work, which is, you know, there's no doubt. I have no doubt your characterization of what Udall and Wyden were doing. But let's face it, if Rand Paul does it, it's going to generate a lot more attention. And furthermore, it actually wound up leading senators who I think otherwise would never have brought this up to bring it up. I mean, it's been pointed out. There was a great National Journal piece by Matt Cooper, I think, that pointed out the true hypocrisy, particularly the Republicans involved. Marco Rubio had no problem with drones up until Rand Paul started filibustering.
Oh, and he had no problem with drones after it, by the way. He voted for Brennan's confirmation. So, you know, and I think to get back to your question of what this says about the Republican Party, you know, the other, I think instead of saying these are the dement Republicans, an interesting thing to note was that everybody who's been mentioned as a 2016 Republican contender who's in the Senate made the point of at least saying something nice about Rand Paul's filibuster, even if, as Rubio did, they then went on to vote for Brennan. So both...
I thought you were going to say, quote, Jay-Z, but yes, go ahead.
So both parties... Well, no, that's not true. Sorry. Both parties are split on the question of how much oversight is necessary and how it should be obtained and how confrontational one should be with the White House in getting it. The Republicans additionally have the problem that they sense that maybe their electorate is where Rand Paul is. But their sort of national security poobahs are John McCain and Lindsey Graham.
Well, all right. This leads to a valid question, which is whether that's actually true. I don't doubt your point that there is a strong faction within the Republican Party for whom the troika of McCain, you know, Ayotte and Graham, you know, are considered to be the important spokespeople. But I'm not sure that's true of the party more generally. And in some ways, I think the most interesting thing about what happened was then the pushback that both Graham and McCain did against Paul the next day. Where, in fact, Lindsey Graham actually said, I think, the most honest thing that I'd heard in the whole 48 hours, which was basically the point of, give me a break, Republicans. You had no problem with these sorts of executive branch, power when George W. Bush was president. Where were all of you in 2007 when this was, or 2006 when this was going on? And I think that's actually a perfectly valid point. You might think they should have been doing it back then, but it does point out that in part it depends on which party's controlling the White House.
Now, this is just a rare moment of bipartisanship on my part, but in point of fact, both the scope and scale of the drone program has changed dramatically since 2006. So were I a Republican, I would have my talking points in response to Lindsey Graham. But your core point is still valid.
Right. And to be fair, I don't know if Graham phrased it in terms of the drone program itself only as opposed to the more general question of executive power during a time of what seemed to be sort of ongoing war.
Or what Lindsey Graham wants to be sure is defined as ongoing war, which, you know, to go back to your so the next steps here are going to be very interesting because you've got a hearing coming up on domestic use of drones next week, which is clearly where the sort of survivalist, libertarian, right-wing energy around the issue is. And then in April, you've got a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing coming up on oversight of the drone program overseas. You've got Senator Durbin saying, you know, I've talked to the White House, and the White House wants to legislate regs and oversight transparency for the drone program. So this is going to go...
And also, didn't Holder say, the Attorney General at some point say that Barack Obama himself, the president, is actually going to speak more at length about all of this?
Yes. So you've got all those things happening. And then running through them underneath, you know, all of them is this question of when is the U.S. at war? How is the U.S. at war? Who decides? You know, last year there was an interesting controversy when General Carter Ham, who's now retired, was going around town asking for a new authorization of use of military force for U.S. operations in Africa. And the White House sat on that pretty vigorously. But there's sort of, you can be of two minds of it. And you can say, well, on the one hand, we don't want to authorize military force and use of military force in Africa because we don't want to use military force in Africa. But there's the Lindsey Graham argument says, well, we don't need a new AUMF, as the abbreviation goes, because since everybody in the world that we want to do anything to is somehow associated with Al-Qaeda, which is the language in the AUMF that's...
The 2001,
The 2001 post-9/11 one. You know, we don't need, and this tends to be the White House's view as well, we don't need a new congressional vote to go after anybody that we can assert with some evidence is somehow linked to Al-Qaeda. And so then your question arises, how does one feel about that as a constitutional scholar? How does one feel about that as a national security policy person, as a civil libertarian, you know, as a scholar of Congress? There's lots of reasons to say, of course, then on the other hand, there's the practical point, which is if this Congress and this House of Representatives in particular actually passed a new AUMF, it would conceivably be even broader than what we've got now. So,
yeah. No, I mean, I think, it's interesting because part of this, I wonder if it's at least a, you know, if you can drop the partisanship for a second, part of this is a clash of cultures in terms of who cares about this, because my hunch is that most foreign policy professionals, generally speaking, are going to sympathize with the executive branch in the sense of not wanting them to have to constantly go to Congress in order to be able to get authorization to do not obviously sort of full-blown war, but the kind of, you know, the kind of drone strikes that have been that we've been talking about, you know, that have been talking about this week. On the other hand, you know, justifiably, civil libertarians and actual partisans and so on and so forth, in fact, want to constrain the executive. And you know, as a general philosophical principle, that is kind of the animating spirit of U.S. government. And then there's the legal question. I mean, my hunch is that, oddly enough, the Lindsey Graham position likely would be correct, at least in terms of legally, the 2001 AUMF probably does cover al-Qaeda affiliates, so therefore there is no need to go back for a reauthorization. The reason to go back isn't legal, it would be political.
Well, no, there's two things, and one is the question of what is an al-Qaeda affiliate. You know, there's no no franchise agreement, there's no golden arches. So that, you know, is a question that arises. Yeah. So, you know, for example, in northern Mali, you have some groups that have explicitly sought to ally themselves with al-Qaeda. You have other groups that are equally reprehensible and haven't ever done that. And on any given, you know, how do you tell who belongs to what on any given day? Just the other place you'd be surprised a little bit, and not that I don't know anyone in any branch of government or any political party who thinks that every single decision should be run through a vote by Congress.
But
I have actually in the last couple of weeks had conversations with some fairly senior ranking retired intelligence professionals who said, you know, I used to hate the notion of more oversight and I used to run away from it, but actually I see it now as a good thing. And
yes.
I who said, you know, really, we're now erring on the side of too little. Which, you know, again, is different from saying, oh, every time we target someone, you know, senators from both parties need to sign off or something. But there is actually in the national security policy community across party lines, you hear it from retired military folks, you hear it from CT folks, saying, you know, especially this business of, quote, signature strikes, unquote, where you're not targeting named known leadership, you're targeting young men who are hanging around on street corners near known militants, saying, you know, this...
Yeah.
Number one, we're not sure it works. We're not sure it actually kills more militants than it recruits. And number two, we're not really comfortable with it as a representation of how the U.S. is in the world. So actually, you know, the interesting thing is that the national this has been like a year now that the national security community has been, people have been quietly saying to each other, you know, we need to think some more about this.
No, and that's a fair point. Although I would say, as you pointed out, these are all retired people that are talking to you about this.
Well, I mean, here's
my point.
There's a fight about it inside government as well, I think, maybe what the limit of what I ought to say. But no, it's not just retired people.
Okay, fair enough. It's just in my experience, and I say this speaking from my own experience as well, when I was working in the executive branch, is that, you know, it was always easy in retrospect to look back and think, yeah, God, Congress was a pack of morons, but actually it was right for them to ask these various questions that they asked, that at the time we were answering them was a royal pain. I don't remember in the heat of the moment loving that process.
No.
But that said, I do grant you that I think, you know, it's been going on for long enough that even people who are still having to deal with it, I think you're right, probably do want to have their hands tied. And there's also, I think, to be fair, what I would call the sort of Jack Goldsmith argument, which says regardless of what the law says the executive branch can or can't do, you want at least some kind of political commitment from beyond the executive branch saying, okay, we sign on to this policy so long as it is done in this way. And that's not an insignificant thing. I mean, it's not just about the law, it's about the politics. One other thing I would point out, though, that I find fascinating about this whole drone business, though, is the fact that it's the drones that's caused the issue.
Yep.
It's not
yep.
JSOC. It's not, you know, in other words, let's assume for the moment that drones did not exist. That instead, what we were simply doing were much larger numbers of special forces attacks, some of which might have taken, you know, let's say.
By the way, we are doing much larger numbers of special forces operations.
And fair enough. And this might answer my question, which is to say, there's something. What is it about drones in particular, as opposed to alternative means of killing, capturing, or whatever the enemy, that has caused this kerfuffle? That's the part that I find fascinating, and I don't have a great answer to that.
So two things. One is when you talk about the policy fixes to this, its policy fixes on targeted killing. And it's targeted killing that's the problem with respect to who are you at war with, who are you allowed to kill, who are you allowed to target. And it doesn't actually matter very much how you then kill them. So we talk about drones because it's sexy, but, you know, you want a policy fix that you know, is targeted killing, you know, say we discover how to do it with aliens in 5 years. But, you know, drones, and you tell me because you're the zombie guy, for heaven's sake, but there's just something, this fascination about the technology and the brave new world aspect of it, and both, you know, both drones' appeal and their scare factor are sort of outsized to the reality, and it's because of, I think, our fascination with technology and the future and the dehumanization of warfare.
Oh, that was good, Heather. I will say, actually, shameless self-promotion, you can actually go and listen to my TED talk that I just gave on zombies in popular culture, and I actually think this applies to drones as well. I think it's one of those ways in which we can think about fears that are tougher to articulate more directly. So I think the fear of drones is somehow related to this notion that we're automating warfare in a way that removes humans as sort of agents of as decision-making agents.
And not just warfare, I would say, which is why the domestic drone thing is so scary to people.
Right, or surveillance. Right. I mean, but the point is, it makes us intuitively uncomfortable. That doesn't mean necessarily that if you think through it, that it's still not the right thing to do. And I think, you know, as much as I appreciate the, you know, Rand Paul's critique and the Democrats' criticism, I always want to know, it goes back to this thing of, it's great that you really don't like the drone business, but, you know, what are you going to do about something like Gitmo, for example, or the other aspects of the global war on terror? The notion that this is just about targeted killings means you have to come up with a substitute policy. And I think one of the true ironies of the Republicans is that what they actually seem to want is fewer targeted killings, more targeted captures, and then enhanced interrogation.
Yep. And also more boots on the ground, by the way, because if you want more capped, you know, not everybody's going to be as easy to pick up as this blowhard Al-Qaeda spokesman who popped up in Jordan. And I don't mean to imply that that was easy in the sense of, you know, easy. Yeah. People put in thousands of hours to do that. But if, you know, there is a really serious moral problem, effectiveness problem, and image problem around the notion that we kill rather than capture. On the other side, do you really want a land invasion and occupation of Yemen? No, you don't.
And on the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong, the capturing part also had its problems in terms of soft power, in terms of how those detainees were dealt with. So it is, again, I'm not saying, therefore, that's not the better option. It very well might be. But what always frustrates me during debates like this is what happens is that the actual policy, whatever the status quo is somehow stigmatized as horrible and awful, and we should never do that again, without thinking about what the alternative is going to wind up being.
So speaking of stigmatized, horrible, and awful, and we should never do that again, shall we move on to the death of Hugo Chavez?
Yes, let's. So Hugo Chavez is dead, which, as I blogged about, you know, leads to the following, you know, ritualistic cycle inside the Beltway, which is you find out on Twitter, it's confirmed by news, then, you know, people who cannot stand this person then, you know, dance on his grave, you know, on Twitter. Then inevitably these sort of formal diplomatic responses by the U.S. government are somehow pilloried by idiots like Jennifer Rubin as somehow being mealy-mouthed without figuring out that, in fact, when George W. Bush was president, he did the exact same thing when, let's say, Yasser Arafat passed away. But the more interesting question is what happens to Venezuela now and or U.S.-Venezuelan relations.
Well,
now,
you left out one part of that cycle, which is critical to the question you raised, which is the ritualistic dance of non-Venezuela experts, such as myself, who then pretend to be experts, when they call you on your TV gig and say, I know you were going to talk about John Kerry in the Middle East and Europe, but how about you talk about Hugo Chavez? And you say, sure. And then you either spend the next 2 hours frantically calling everyone you know who does Latin America, or you don't.
No, someone tweeted this at the very end of the day Chavez died, saying, so how many days is it going to be where everyone proclaims to be a Latin American expert? And, you know, the I think it was thawed until Sunday at
right.
least.
So I'm still in the mode of saying that I've read lots of Latin America experts, and we at NSN did a nice piece on this, which you can find on the website, that summarized the views of many people more learned than myself. But, you know, the interesting thing, sort of the, we're going to see in the short term, the wonderful line that, gosh, now I don't remember who said this, so I can't give him credit for it, was that the vice president who is now acting and will run for president, that he would have to be more Chavez right. than Chavez. And yeah. indeed, on the day that Chavez died, he got off to a good start by kicking out an American military attaché and claiming that, you know, that the West had given Chavez cancer.
Oh, yes. I forgot the other ritualistic part of this whole process, which is the conspiracies that inevitably sprout up surrounding the death of the great leader.
So phase one is, you know, is the vice president will act more Chavez than Chavez, which will then give the right-wing Venezuelan emigre community in the U.S. the opportunity to jump up and down and yell at the administration about, you know, why haven't we occupied Venezuela yet? Why haven't we supported a returning army, et cetera, et cetera? And then, you know, the much more interesting question unfolds over time, which is to say, once nobody is paying attention and we've all gone back to admitting that we're not Venezuela experts, you know, which is, you know, Chavez was personally very charismatic, and a small voice is heard. So, Lev, you can have some bonus device time if you would like. So, folks, we're in bonus time now.
We're in extra time.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, and my son thanks all of you for giving him extra iPhone time. But so the questions are: first of all, you know, Chavez was basically giving oil away to his own population, giving oil away to the Cubans in return for which the Cubans were giving him health personnel and state security forces. Can that be sustained over time? What does it do to Cuba if Cuba has to start buying its own oil at real world prices? Can anybody sustain the public support that Chavez had? So that's the sort of interesting inside
right.
Venezuela question. And then there's, you know, does this give Washington an opening to start trying to do more in Latin America, that we had gotten into such a bad rut where Chavez was really able to run around and get a lot of cheap points at our expense, and the U.S. has been very preoccupied ending wars and so on elsewhere. Meanwhile, Latin America has grown faster than Europe for the last 8 years.
Yes, but that's a low bar, to be fair. But yeah, okay,
you know, look, would you rather be investing in Brazil or in Greece right now?
Actually, to tell you the truth, Greece. But that's my counterintuitive nature. But I take your larger
yeah,
point.
Yeah, so this it poses a challenge for Washington, but it's not necessarily the challenge you think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the other problem there particular, I blogged about this as well. I think one of the issues is that truly Venezuela might be the most conspiracy-ridden country in a region that is rife with conspiracy theories. I mean, conspiracy theories are very popular in both Latin America and the Middle East, but Venezuela in particular is in some ways a perfect breeding ground for particularly anti-American conspiracy theories, because you have a situation where you're in a region that the U.S. has long bullied for a whole variety of reasons, plus there was the tacit to at least mild support that the United States had for the attempted coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002. Plus, as you say, the vice president is going to have to be more Chavez than Chavez. And how can you get more Chavez than accusing the United States of various machinations, including, I believe, cancer drones or whatever it was that was responsible for allegedly infecting Chavez? That said, it is worth remembering that Hugo Chavez really, really managed to run Venezuela almost into the ground in terms of the economy, that he profited from a decade where energy prices went up dramatically, and it should have been a massive windfall for Venezuela's economy. And instead, essentially, you know, there were some mild improvements, I believe, in sort of the poorest of the poor in Venezuela. But by and large, that economy should be a hell of a lot richer than it actually is. And they're going to be in deep trouble if particularly this is where it gets tied into questions about how much the U.S. will need Venezuelan oil. One of the grand ironies I always thought about Chavez's rule was however much he railed against the United States, the simple fact of life was that the kind of oil that Chavez, that that got extracted from Venezuela could pretty much only be refined in the United States. And so as a result, if you took a look at actual trading relationships, there was no fundamental change in that, which was why it wasn't that big of a deal. With respect to your larger point about U.S. relations with Latin America, I mean, I would say, you know, once Obama got elected, I think a lot of the sort of really blatant anger at the United States kind of disappeared. And in some ways, you could argue potentially the most significant thing from an immigration deal being negotiated in Washington is that it might at least put somewhat that issue a little bit to the side in terms of how the U.S. deals with other Latin American countries. But truthfully, I mean, I would argue that in the end, the country that matters in that region isn't Venezuela, it's Brazil.
Well, you have Brazil on the one hand, Mexico on the other. Yeah. Mexico, which is also at a pretty significant juncture. And there is, as you say, the anger has ebbed out of the U.S.-Latin American relationship, but I think there's a certain amount of frustration both in the region and among Latin Americanists and economic people, focused folks in the U.S., that there's a lot more that could be being done, you know, with the relationship. And in some ways, it's another example of how the post 9/11 hangover and how it's gotten much harder for a U.S. government to focus foreign affairs on multiple regions of the world at the same time. And so the degree of energy going to Latin America just hasn't been what everybody wishes it could be.
Yes. No, that's an absolutely safe statement. I agree with you totally on that. And, you know, look, if there's nothing else that the United States has proved in the post 9/11 era, is that we actually can't walk and chew gum at the same time. I used to think we could in foreign policy. It turns out for some reason we can't, you know, it's harder for us to do that now. So, you know, as much as I would welcome more attention to Latin America, the question always comes, where are you drawing that attention from? But that said, I do agree with you that there are potential opportunities here. In some ways, I'm less intrigued about Venezuela and more by Cuba, whether or not there would actually be some sort of you know, major impact to that regime. Because in some ways, that Cuba is actually, I think, the larger irritant at this point than Venezuela.
Well, but the reasons that Cuba's a larger irritant are domestic to the United States.
Yeah.
You know, let's not. And yes. The other thing which is interesting to note, and that I've, over the last couple of years, had a number of conversations sort of worst casing, you know, what happens if Chavez dies at X moment? What happens if Castro dies at Y moment? And the expert, you know, whenever I would go to experts and say, hey, what do I need to know in case this happens and reporters call me and I need to pretend to know something, people always said, oh, well, Castro has devolved most of his power and Cuba will go through a transition very smoothly. Venezuela, on the other hand, that won't happen. So far, Venezuela is actually doing better than the experts say said it would. And Chavez took just long enough to die that the people around him did figure out, you know, something of a succession, and it's gone more smoothly than experts, you know, thought when we first started talking about this a couple of years ago that it would.
Although it's only 48 hours. I mean, you never
know
what's going
to happen. But in the medium term, you do have, you know, the potential for significant sort of centripetal energy in bad ways in Venezuela, whether it's disrupting world oil markets, whether it's border clashes with Colombia, whether it's you know, getting into it with Colombia in ways that destabilize the sort of fragile progress that's being made in Colombia, other, you know, regional economic issues. So, you know, I wouldn't just write Venezuela off as, oh, it's not that fascinating, because in point of fact, you know, and given that, you know, we ain't getting off fossil fuels in the next 3 years, you do actually, and, you know, given where we are with Iran, and so, like, we don't really need any extra exogenous shocks to global oil markets.
No dispute there. Although I would note that, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think oil prices have actually gone up all that much over the last 2 days, which is perhaps the best sign that or the best data point for your argument that whatever Chavez needed to do, he did before he died. You know, thereby at least ensuring some kind of.
Although a point you raised that actually should be reiterated in this context is that one of the things Chavez was not able to do because of how he chose to spend his money was invest in modernizing the Venezuelan oil sector. So.
Oh, no, if anything, actually the reverse. Basically, Chavez used the state oil company, PDVSA, as it was basically a massive ATM for him of paying off his political supporters, which, you know, is not shocking when it comes to oil money. The problem is that in Chavez's case, PDVSA actually was thought to be one of the best state-run oil companies in the 90s, and no one thinks it's even remotely close to that now. So it'll be interesting to see over the long term the extent to which you see that. Whether or not the company.
And to spell out again how much you know, in fact, U.S. domestic politics and Latin American politics are meshed together, the nightmare scenario that some experts raised to me as the thing they were most worried about happening was, so you have a disruption in Venezuela, which leads the Venezuelans to stop supplying the Cubans with cheap oil, which leads the Cuban economy to collapse, which leads to a human exodus to Florida.
Yeah, no, that's entirely possible.
And then just think about what the interesting things that then does to American politics.
Yes. So really, we are, in the end, ultimately, so domestic on our origins. We've managed to get from the death of Hugo Chavez to how will it affect Marco Rubio's 2016
And we started off with talking about Marco Rubio and drones.
And so we've come full circle.
Now, I do just want to mention, as a sort of an extra treat at closing, that I saw a bumper sticker the other day, which Professor Dresner really must have. And I was a good girl and did not stop and scrape it off the car that it was on. But if any of our viewers have ever seen this, it said, "I eat living flesh and I vote."
I want that bumper sticker.
So Dan really...
I desperately need that bumper
sticker.
Yes.
For his zombie sideline.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, it was a pleasure as always, Heather. I'd like to thank your 8-year-old for tolerating us, although I'm sure he appreciated the extra
iPhone
time.
Well, I want to shout out to the team at National Security Network and our neighbors at Clean Water Action, because I believe he is now running laps up and down the hall.
That's good. It tires him out. It'll be ready for.
So
it for
takes
a
village to film a blogging heads.
Yes, you know, we did. So next time we do this, we'll have to do the whole Sheryl Sandberg, Amory Slaughter, you know, question.
So I have not read the book, and I have vowed that I am not going to be one of those people who foams at the mouth about a book I haven't read. So that's a challenge. I'll actually have to read.
Agreed.
The book.
That's we'll make that. This is one of those things where I agree. I've noticed everyone like. There's been a whole rush of critical coverage, and now suddenly everyone's pointing out no one read the book when they gave that coverage. So, you know, maybe we'll do this again having read the book, and we can talk about this particularly for foreign policy professionals.
Excellent. Take care till then.
All right.